listening to The Bob Dean Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Bob Dean Show. Yay! It is Christmas time, and today, along with the ladies that are joining us, the Virgin Mary is also here. Hi, Mary. And we'd like to say Merry Christmas to everybody coming up. We've got some great... Listen, by the way, it's going to be the usual comedy of errors from my area down here. The Happy Birthday Baby Jesus Cocktail Soiree is our annual party that's a benefit for LA Animal Services and private shelters on Christmas Eve. Well, I've got lots and lots of meat in the refrigerator that I roast and the oven roast. So the repair people are here, and they might be tiptoeing in and out. From Santos Appliance Repair. We'll plug them. Sam Mason, my producer and friend. Hello, good afternoon. And today, guys, we have got a great show. Linda Schneider is back. Yay, Linda.
Hi.
And today, joining her are her friends and new friends. The I memorized your name, and here I go because I'm all nervous. Suzanne and Jean Vincent. Hello,
Hi.
Ladies.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. Welcome to the Bob Dean Show. Yay.
Thank you.
It's raining cats and dogs in Los Angeles, which is the equivalent of a winter storm for you guys.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're with me, but the appliance repair people are here because they have to be. And the gardeners next door are using their leaf blower. So
perfect.
Fun times.
Perfect.
Yeah. You know, all we need is like a jet to crash into the side of the building. But yeah, we have the Happy Birthday Baby Jesus Cocktail Soiree. I don't know if you noticed that the Virgin Mary has joined us here today.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and Joseph's over there, but they're not plugged in. It's a benefit for, I foster animals, mostly cats, been doing it for 10, 12 years. And on Christmas Eve, we have this great party. It's really just, it's an open house. And everybody brings donations that they have on the wish list for the shelters, like cat food, dog food, blankets, etc. And my old Buick station wagon in the driveway, we wrap in lights, and that's called the sleigh. And then I cook for a couple of days, prime rib. I roast, I get up on Christmas Eve morning at about 10 and put in the Vince Guaraldi Charlie Brown Christmas and make a big pitcher of Bloody Marys. And I use my neighbor's oven and back and forth, and it's just a great party. We're looking forward to it. That's why the fellas are here, because my oven didn't work and I started to almost cry.
Oh, no. Well, we'll have to fly in next year and attend the soiree. It sounds like a lot of fun.
It's a gas. It used to be an all-night thing because, as you know, I'm an actor and a comedian and a podcast host, which means I'm a bartender. And I used to just let the party go because people that worked in restaurants would come. But the police kept showing up at about 2 a.m. every year. So I had to put a cap on it. So, Linda, your tree is...
Bloody Marys.
Oh, exactly. Well, that's what happens. Which one are you? Are you Jean or Suzanne?
I'm Jean, yeah. This is Jean.
Hi, Jean. Hi, Jean. Yeah, I get. I make no apologies for it. I'm just hammered when people start showing up. Usually, I'm wearing a bathrobe and smoking a cigarette on the bars outside.
And that's the way it should really be.
It's a lot of fun. So your tree is beautiful, Linda.
Thank you. It's big.
Yes, it's very big and beautiful.
It looks like it, and of course, you can see that. I wish I could. Turn this around so you can see. We call this my partner Dennis.
Hi.
Hi, Dennis.
We call it the Dingy Bachelor Pad.
Hi, Dennis.
Hello.
And we call it the Dingy Bachelor Pad. And for Los Angeles standards, it's a pretty cool apartment. But it started off with some remodeling. And I'm going to stop talking about all this crap so we can get to you guys. But anyway, it's like a bomb blew up in here because they put in a new kitchen and painted and all that sort of thing. And so I have like 2 days to put everything back. And that's it. So let's talk about you guys, the Psychic Sisters. That is so intriguing. And I was reading about you until the wee hours of the morning. And I have my notes here, but I just wanted to talk with you guys. Now, you're from Chicago originally. You were born in suburban Chicago, correct?
Actually, I was born in Chicago, the far south side of Chicago, so it's within the city limits, yeah. And then
right,
later on, we moved out to the suburbs.
And you've been in Pittsburgh for how long?
Oh, I'd probably say about 35 years, if not more.
Yeah, as Linda knows, my family, my parents are from Brownsville and Uniontown. So I used to spend a lot of time in the Pittsburgh area as a kid. Now, your grandmother came to you, according to the things that I've read. And that's when you guys realized you had a calling?
Yes, a couple of days after my grandmother died very suddenly, I was over at my grandfather's house sleeping, and I seen a vision of her come towards me. She was like hovering towards the end of the bed with a buzzing sound and like a white light. And she came to me and she said, I have a message to give Grandpa and give my mother. And she said they were looking for items of value because she had died so suddenly. And my grandmother was Irish, so she believed in saving things for a rainy day. And she gave me this vision that the papers that they were looking for were in the hutch. She had put away savings bonds and cash for a rainy day. And on Sunday, when we went to dinner at her house, my grandfather was very stern, and he was a teacher. And I was telling him about her, this vision I had seen and this message, and they started to tear the hutch apart. You know, they looked in the drawers, and the vision was it was on the bottom side of the hutch. And when they turned over the drawer, it was taped. It was taped, this all this stuff. She was Irish. She believed in, you know, having pin money put away. And so they found, and then from then on, she used to come and give me messages for the family.
What was her name?
Her name was Mary.
Mary.
A good Irish name.
Absolutely. It must have been, was it unnerving at all when she first came?
I would say it was, you know, I used to watch all those shows like Creature Features and all that stuff. So when you see this video, of course, you're going to get scared. But then when she got closer to me and I could recognize it was Grandma in another dimension, then I wasn't scared. I started to feel very peaceful. I knew she was okay. And she would come to me and say she was okay on the other side and would give us information. Actually, she came to all my sisters.
See, that's what I was going to ask you, because as the things I was reading, do your any other siblings or your mom have any kind of connection ability or, you know, gift?
My mother was a spiritualist teacher. She was also a spiritualist. She taught Reiki and she taught healing, and she also taught meditation and intuition. So we learned a lot from her, the New Age religion, I guess you'd call it. So intuitively, our whole family has it in their own way.
She did past life regressions. You know, she was Catholic. She believed in contact with the saints for information. You know, she was very New Age. She believed by taking us to a spiritualist church that we could connect to loved ones on the other side, and they were able to teach us and to help us, besides my mother, you know, coming back home and showing us different methods, how to meditate and how to connect with spirit, you know, and through different mediumships too. Like you can do it through like cards, or you can do it through like looking at teacups or water, stuff like that you can meditate on.
I have a friend that I'd like for you guys to connect with. Her name is Jennifer Diamond, and she is also a gifted person. And she was in an accident when she was young, and which she was in a coma, and when she came out of the coma, she has the gift. And she is in Fort Lauderdale. She's formerly here, but she's a wonderful person, and she likes to connect. She's written a couple books and interviewed a lot of gifted people. I hope gifted is a word to, I prefer, I mean, I like saying that, because I believe you guys are gifted. Does that make you comfortable? Is that all right?
I would say we're gifted, yes.
Yeah, cool. I got it right. Now, you guys have such an impressive, you've been featured on Biography Channel, Discovery Channel, NBC's Dateline, and a ton of other things, as well as lecturing and writing. So just go ahead and please just tell us about yourselves. And the key, I mean, you guys still do, but a lot of work with law enforcement, correct?
And yes, yes.
And searching for lost folks and just, you know, things, please go into detail if you would for our audience. Oh, wait, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, please call in if you have questions for the Vincent Sisters or Linda Schneider or myself at 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Let's get those calls coming in, ladies and gentlemen. So go ahead, Suzanne, Jean, Linda.
Well, we decided when we were doing this that we wanted a theme for today. So one of the things that we talked about was Ghost of Christmas Past. There have been a lot of famous murders that happened either on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. So that was what we were going for today with the whole topic of discussion. They have so many years of background with so many different cases that are famous, but we thought it would be fun, since it's officially your Christmas show, to talk about some of the famous Christmas murders. You guys up for that?
Yeah. Yeah. And then we can talk about a few of those, and then we can kind of talk about a couple of the other cases that why we were on, you know, like Dateline and Travel Channel. But yeah. So yeah, go ahead. Which one do you think she would start with? There's a lot of good murders, a lot of murderers that like to kill people on Christmas or Christmas Eve.
This is true. Let's talk about the most famous Christmas murder that I can recall, and that's JonBenet Ramsey, which is still unsolved.
Mm-hmm. Yes, JonBenet Ramsey is such a big mystery, you know, that she was found dead on, you know, Christmas Eve. And they had thought for the longest time that it was somebody in the family, but now they're actually looking to outside people that maybe
there was so much speculation about her brother and her parents and Linda, and she passed from cancer, the father. But there was the Santa Claus or whatever that snuck in through the conjecture or whatever that slipped and came in through the bedroom. There was a teacher that confessed. And then her brother was a suspect for a long time. He was nine years old.
That suitcase they found with, you know, they thought that was evidence that something had been going on for a long time with her being abused.
I always thought that the mother covered up for the son, but the son was autistic or something like that. So that's why I think the mother wrote the note, which they said was Patsy's handwriting. Along with, I never thought he did it. I think somebody in the neighborhood did. And there is a known pedophile who had the same pattern of killing a child who lived probably about 4 or 5 blocks from the Ramsey home in Colorado.
Well, I know that from when Jeannie and I went to the cold case, Cyril Weck's cold case seminar a few years back. And one of the cases they had talked about to try to figure out, you know, new evidence or new things to try to solve it. I know that one of the FBI agents I spoke with told me that the handwriting was definitely in Patsy's handwriting. And so that leads me back into the house again, that somebody inside the house more likely had something to do with it. And also, they said that JonBenet had pineapple chunks in her stomach. And they had said that Burke fingerprints was on the bowl. And so
the pineapple was a big part of that case, because that what the kids were supposed to have argued over it on Christmas Eve or something like that. That's from what I've read.
I think like jealousy or envy or anger, you know, is why people kill. And I think Burke and JonBenet had a rough relationship. I don't think he did it. I think the family thought he did it because they were always fighting. So I think they thought, well, he's young still. We don't know about his mental health yet, but he does act a little unique. And I do believe the family somehow that up, thinking that, you know, he may have something to do with it. But I don't think she was being abused. Something was going on, but I don't believe he did it. I still feel an outside source did it. So the pineapple, you know, had them fighting like usual, but they also had a Christmas party that evening. So I believe that person was somehow connected or knew or was just, you know, perfect timing. And maybe jealous of the random of where they lived, the lifestyle, jealousy, envy, anger is what these killers go for, especially Christmas represents, you know, a perfect time. And if the person was a pedophile a couple of blocks away, he already did prison time. He already did, you know, he didn't have that kind of a lifestyle.
Patsy Ramsey, I guess JonBenet used to wet the bed. And when a child wets the bed at 5 or 6 years old, usually it means there's some sort of a sexual thing has been going on in their life where they've been abused. And speculation had said that maybe she was angry, Patsy, and that she, you know, slapped her or hit her and accidentally killed her because she wet the bed that night and that the family covered it up. But I go inside the house. I still think that somebody, a family member inside the house, had something to do with JonBenet Ramsey's death. Because another thing downstairs near the window where they said that they used to have the Christmas lights coming in and that there was like a window open, there was cobwebs all over the place.
And right, so, that's what I, and it was like a basement window, correct?
Yes.
And yeah, it was cracked open, but the cobwebs hadn't been disturbed at all. There was right. And she was found, like, they had a huge home in Boulder, and wasn't like in the basement, it wasn't like the poor JonBenet was right there in the basement. It was like kind of a catacomb that went right. back like to back a heating unit or yeah.
And that's why they didn't find the body initially. It was a little while before they found her body.
Because they thought she had run away or been kidnapped, right?
Right. And why, as a mother, would you write a letter to direct the police in a different direction? Why would you not be all over wanting your daughter's murderer, you know, brought to justice? Why would you do something like that?
I think there was multiple things going on. So many cover-ups that, you know, it was like two whodunits.
Well, they got a lot of DNA now. All they have to do is match it up. But the crime scene was so, everyone was everywhere. So they probably have DNA from anybody, not necessarily the killer.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had a friend back in Nashville. I won't mention any names, but some people I went to high school with very close. Their oldest sister was a student at Vanderbilt, and she was, it started off with on Easter Sunday, a little girl in Nashville, Marcia Trimble, had gone a couple days before. I take that back. A month before, she had gone in a very affluent, lovely community. She was delivering Girl Scout cookies, and it was just about dusk, and her mother said, "Put on your jacket." She said, "I'm just going next door," and boom, she disappeared. And it was in Nashville. It wasn't the Nashville that everybody loves now. It was a very, very small community back in 1974. And even I was just a little kid. And Marcia Trimble disappeared. And, you know, the town was in it. And one guy at Hillsborough High School, just as a joke, said, "Oh, I did it." And it ruined his life with, you know, the speculation and the police. And it was, I don't know how many years later, this is about DNA. It was 20, 25 years later. They found her killer, and her killer also had murdered the college age of my friends, their older sister. The point being is that it was solved with DNA, and that is just incredible what they can do with that.
We're going to be out of a job.
I don't think that.
We volunteer, so it's not a job exactly.
And for some reason, another Christmas Eve one, which is horrific, was a Lacey Peterson.
Oh, yeah.
Murder.
Oh, my God, yes. Lacey Peterson.
With Scott Peterson, you know, killing his wife and child on Christmas Eve. So,
right. Yeah, that's such a big case. And her mother, you know, we've all followed that because her family supported Scott, you know, wholeheartedly at the beginning.
They did.
And what a jerk. You know,
he was a classic killer, classic narcissist, ego driven, all about him, his needs, and just no empathy for, you know, having a newborn. Connor would have been the baby name, and even gaslighting the other woman who had no idea that he was married with a baby. He's your classic killer, narcissist, psycho.
He was definitely a psycho, but in his high school, he was a gifted golfer. And one of his teammates was Phil Mickelson, the great golfer. And during high school, I guess on the teams, they had asked him to be off the team, and he never got over it. So he always thought he was special. He was very smart and, a sociopath. And he just wanted to have all these affairs, and he just decided that he was done with his wife, and he was going to get away with just dumping her out in the ocean and killing her. But he did it on Christmas Eve.
And they thought she had gone to walk their golden retriever or something like that. They were talking with neighbors and such. I'm trying to think of the woman's name. I can see her face, and she was she was helped to. This is Lily, one of our fosters.
Look at her. She's looking for a new home.
Hello. What was her name? Because I watched they did a 60 Minutes or something, and she told the whole story, and she was, she immediately went to the police the moment that she realized.
Right. Amber?
Amber Fry.
Yes.
Amber. Yeah. And she was, bless her heart. I mean, she got drug into that, but she was immediately, and of course the speculation is going to go to her. She had something to do with it and that sort of thing, but she really helped put that case together.
Yeah, she really did. She kept him kind of on the hook and didn't let him know the police were talking to her.
I remember it's so tragic. I hate you. In 2008, this guy it's called the Covina Massacre, suburban Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Remember what we're talking about? That I remember because we had the party, the Happy Birthday Baby Jesus cocktail soiree. And that morning, it was raining, just like it is now. It was it's pouring, which is creepy for LA. It was pouring. And I was watching, I turned on the news, and they were showing the home smoldering and such. And when they described what that guy had done, I've got his name written down here. Jeffrey Pardo, okay?
Yes.
Bruce Jeffrey Pardo. He went to his ex-wife's home. They had only been divorced for a short period of time, like a couple weeks or whatever. And he just opened fire, and it was a huge family traditional Christmas Eve gathering.
Wasn't he dressed as Santa Claus too?
He was dressed as Santa Claus, and an 8-year-old little girl, his niece, ran to the door, I guess, seeing Santa, and he shot her first. And then he just opened fire. He also had 15 or 18 gallons of gasoline in a flamethrower that he had designed. And I mean, his ex-wife, they had only been married. They had dated for like 2 years. They had only been married for about a year. And he was the same kind of a character, I believe, as Scott Peterson. Where he just wanted everything his way. And he, she had three children before. And in their relationship, he was like, you're responsible for that. I'm not going to have anything to do with any kind of, finances going toward your kids and that sort of thing. And what he had set it all up to, he had rented cars all over LA because he was going to leave that residence after the mayhem and go to her divorce attorney. There was another car found there, but he didn't make it because he burned himself so badly with this makeshift flamethrower that he drove to his brother's house and shot himself. But, it was just,
Yeah, that was a horrific one out there in Covina, when especially showing up as Santa Claus, he's just a sociopath. And there's so many like that across the country. These, crazy killers killing, like he's a serial killer killing that whole family. But I know a couple of cases that we have done over here that we were on the A&E for was lots of times when we do these cases, we volunteer our time with family members, law enforcement, or whoever needs us. And there was a murder up here in Blairsville of a dentist. And we were invited up to a psychic tea party with the Psychic Vincent Sisters, that's what we go by. And it was during this reading with Melissa Utes, who was a good friend of the murdered dentist and lived next door to his childhood home. And we had brought in such details about it because during the reading, sometimes you can ask questions. She said, you know, they think my husband did this. And so they were very much questioning her husband and her son. And we had brought in the psychic information by profiling that was actually a police officer and that he had reddish hair and he was around 5'10". And a lot of different information to be brought and delivered to the DA. So the DA had invited us, my sister Jean and I, back to do a walkabout through the house. And Jean, she actually took somebody downstairs.
Yeah, so
I was upstairs.
It was pretty intense going into a crime scene. You know, we've done things like over the phone or, you know, just kind of gave the information, but to be lucky enough to be at a horrific, bloody crime scene and not know the details and pick up the details. I had a uniform officer, my sister also did, and we went separately. She went upstairs, I went downstairs, and the first thing I felt was this guy was bloodied and just kind of like bled out. And I see things with movie stars and with just movies, and I saw the twins from The Shining and the blood coming forward. I told the officer, I go, he bled out. Someone cut him, you know, almost decapitated his head. I go, that's what I'm seeing, even to the point where underneath in the downstairs, the wooden beam, I said, you know, when I was upstairs, I said, there'll be blood. He just drained through the first floor into the downstairs. And that law enforcement officer was just, how do you know this? So I had to give him a little mini lesson, but you have to give detailed information. And the look of the person who did it was a state trooper, and he looked like Michael Rapaport to me. So when I gave the description, it was the red hair, the light eyes, the high forehead, and the demeanor, him being, you know, that New York attitude or military or cop attitude. And this was all the attributes that the killer had. He was in the military, and he was in law enforcement. We're just a spoke on the wheel. Law enforcement has to go interview and dig deeper, but we give them a long checklist of detailed information. And then when they come back and say, yes, you know, these are hits and more hits, they spend even more time with us.
Weren't you a little bit afraid when you realized that it was law enforcement that was the murderer that you were?
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. It must have been kind of a shock.
I was very afraid because, you know, you honor law enforcement. They do a fantastic job. And it was just kind of like, wow, a major good old boy cover up. I told the DA, I said, you know, you got some problems here. And while that was going on, I did have a couple of Indiana state troopers come into my county, which were like three counties away, up and down my street. So that was a nice subtle hint saying, you know, what's one more in the Allegheny River?
So getting back inside the house, my sister goes one way, I go the other way. And if we both pick up the same information separately, we're like two bookends. We come together and then we talk about it. Like we picked up that he had the person that killed John Yelnick drove a maroon colored SUV. We had picked up that for a while he lived down in Florida and that he was in the military. And that when we went over to the dining room, psychically, we could see that the person who killed John had worn a size 10 shoe, like an Azex or a Nike, which turned out to be correct. And then John had described the scene to us about how somebody with a knife had, you know, sliced his neck out. And nobody knew about that. And so the police were very interested. And I believe that we were given the details is because Melissa's husband, for the longest time, people thought he did it. They thought that he did it because Melissa had a crush on John and that he was jealous. And that wasn't the case. And even up to the trial of Kevin Foley, all the neighbors were talking about Melissa's husband. Maybe he had something to do with it. And they were actually going to testify because the night that he was killed, He was supposed to sign his divorce papers, and you know, and so that his wife would not be getting like $4,000 a month. And also, Melissa Use was given a check of $15,000 by the dentist, and he had asked for that back. So that night, when he was knifed to death, the checks were sitting there, all covered with blood. The check that Melissa's check, and then also the divorce papers that he never had a chance to sign. And going forward, all the money that he owned and everything did go on to the wife because he was not divorced.
And just like it's right out of a television drama, just, you know, moments before she would have been out of everything and that this horrible thing happens.
If he would have signed that paper, she wouldn't have had anything.
Nothing.
Minutes before signing. Blood on the document.
Now we were very good with the chief of police in Blairsville, and it's still an open case. Kevin Foley got 25 years because we firmly believe that there's a second person involved. It's just, is Kevin give it up? Are the police going to be able to, you know, find out some more information? And so it's still open, you know, and if somebody, was to, lack of a better term, frenzy up somebody to kill somebody, that's against the law too. Like if they said, you know, this person's a pedophile, or this person, you know, did child abuse, sexual child abuse, because the rumors were, which were not true, that Michelle had put out there that John Yelnick had supposedly molested their adopted son, which was not true. And so perhaps she frenzied up the state trooper to a point that, you know, the buck stops here, and I'm going to kill John Yelnick. So it's a lot of interesting stories connected to it, but he's doing 25 years to life. And because of that, we volunteered our time with that. Because of that, we only do like referrals, or we do, you know, police departments and things like that, because we volunteer hours and hours and months on a case to try to solve it. So from that case, a family member had told us about a missing girl down in near Pocomoke City, Maryland, named Christine Shetty. So we volunteered our case onto the Christine Shetty one that she had went down for a weekend with some friends. She had disappeared, and they didn't know what happened to her. A month or two, the police, they don't know. They're not going to go look for a needle in a haystack. They just kind of do what they do. So we were asked to become involved in that. G and I had taken several weeks to pick up information, talking with the mother, Linda Odenhoff, who'd listened to every single lead that we had. And we were right. You know, we actually, on the very first reading with her on the phone, Spirit had yelled out a name called Tia to us. And then also I kept hearing J's, like Jackson. I go, this Tia and Jackson have something to do with it. And the mom and the aunt said that they were new friends and that they knew who this Tia was and knew who this Jackson guy was. And so when I spoke with the police department, you know, when the mother had gotten in touch with the lieutenant and the captain, gave all that information to them. And at first they weren't too interested because they wanted to blame her husband. And so it turned out to be that the person that killed Christine was, in fact, a guy named Jackson and his cousin named Justin. And that's how come we got onto 6 degrees of murder investigation discovery, because of the details that we gave about where and what the person, the profile, the person who killed, you know, Christine Shetty.
And some of the details were when we gave a description, what some of his attributes were. And I had told Lynn and her sister and also law enforcement that the person who did it was a little bit of a firebug. He likes to start fires. He'll be the one that you'll have to eyeball and focus on. And so Lynn and her sister did and told the cops that too. I was asked, would it get solved? And I said, absolutely. He would plea bargain an arson case and you would find Christine. Exactly how I said she'd be found in a sand dirt mix at the bed and breakfast with the water. We're natural remote viewers. We see a vision and we can write that down. And I wrote the landscape of how she'd be found, and it was a dead on match. So
can I interrupt for just 1 second, please? Because I want to get back to the Shetty. I just want to give a shout out, everybody in Los Angeles, to Santos Appliance Repair. Jaime and Mr. Santos were here. They saved the Happy Birthday Baby Jesus cocktail soiree. Thank you, Jaime.
Pleasure. So, my savior. Thank
you. He fixed the stove. So everybody just, you know, you call Santos. Although Mr. Santos and I did have an argument over my air conditioner once. He's a great guy. They're great people. And they do great work. And thank you. Merry Christmas to you, sir. They're right here at the Bob Dean Show. Everybody, you can call us in now. We're not getting any calls today. 323. Sam, show that number, please.
Well, getting back on the Christine Shetty case,
that's what I wanted to do.
The mother was involved every step of the way. And during a reading, how do you tell a mother that the people that killed their daughter buried her and then they dug her back up and buried them someplace else at the bed and breakfast? And that's exactly what happened. And then she was on TV in Delaware, and somebody had reached out to her offering to help. And that person also was working on the Kaylee Anthony missing persons. And so we got involved in the Kaylee Anthony missing persons because of Lynn Dodenhoff and people reaching out to her. And so we had right in the beginning, I think it was maybe the end of July. I do believe that Kaylee went missing in June. And we had picked up such detailed information about the mother being involved with it, her being buried very close by, maybe within a half a mile, a place that maybe, you know, teenagers would go drink or smoke cigarettes at. We also had said that there was a chain link fence, an abandoned house. And so we were working with an intermediary that was working with Dominic Casey, the private investigator. And at that time, their whole camp down there had said that Kaylee Anthony was taken away by Nanny the Zanny and that she was alive. In the very beginning, you know, we knew that she was dead. So it came full circle that we were involved with these other two people that were friends with Dominic Casey, the private eye, the intermediary. And they kept saying through the emails that came out during the court hearing that they were alive and down in Florida with Nanny the Zanny. And so Jeannie and I, you know, we tried to work with the team with them because Lynn Dodenhoff had asked us to. And so we kind of broke off with those other two, and Jeannie and I had our own opinion. But it was 100% right what we did. And also, we definitely feel that the person that did it is Casey. Casey definitely had something to do with it. And I do believe there's another person involved. It's just time will tell.
Now, you got Jeannie, Suzanne, do you guys ever like get the same vision, like when you're investigating, you were talking about the chain link fence, et cetera. Do you ever have, were you both tuned in on something? Because obviously you collaborate with the things that you're learning, seeing. But have you,
yes, does that ever happen? We get identical things. And then we also get other things too. But we usually get everything the same. And then we just kind of fine tune it. So we both have the gift from our mother, but, you know, she might get a different kind of energy to interpret it, but we'll get the same kind of energy, then I'll see a different angle of that energy. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah.
But when the two of them are reading at the same time, it's really, really something else.
Do you ever, like, answer each other's questions and that sort of thing? I mean, sentences, do you finish each other's sentences kind of thing? Are you like, how many years apart are you?
Six years.
And how many, and go ahead.
People have told us that Jeannie and I can actually finish each other's sentences. Like when we're talking about crime cases or picking up stuff, it's like we can almost finish, the energy is there. The psychic energy is floating around us, helping us to finish sentences. And then also we're talking about things. So we definitely have a psychic connection with that runs in our whole family.
How many siblings do you have? Sorry, go ahead, Jeannie.
I do it because my mother loved all the spiritual stuff. And when she would say, good job, Jane, I would try to outdo her. So that's why I think I became so great at this, because my mom would just give me a little pat on that head and say, good job. So I do it for her. And I did do it for her just for the attention from my mother, which I love dearly.
Because she would, like, invite...
And what was your mother's name?
Margaret Mary.
Margaret, okay.
Like, she would invite a neighbor over who maybe lost her husband. And she would say, girls, you're so good at, you know, giving closure to people. Can you please do a reading for Helen? And, you know, obviously I want to go out and, you know, enjoy life and do different things. But she said, oh, it means so much to me. And then we would read Helen and we'd bring in her husband, Charlie. Then she'd say, oh, by the way, girls, did you hear about that missing girl or that missing person? You guys are so gifted. Why don't we all get together at the kitchen table and see if we can help? And so there's been a lot of major cases that we worked on with my mother going back, you know, 35 years ago, 40 years ago, that we had help with because we're remote viewers. And one of the cases was the Audie Murphy missing airplane. And through the Spiritualist Church, through the people that
the Puritan Spiritualist Church,
the Spiritualist Church, and the
Civil Air Patrol
had reached out, and they had asked us, you know, because my mother had a reputation of being a remote viewer and a medium, if we could all help. And so we had picked up detailed information about where Audie Murphy's plane was missing, and we actually talked to the Air Patrol people as they were looking for it in Roanoke and those areas. And they were actually looking in the wrong direction, in the wrong mountaintop. And they had said that they would fly my mom and me down. And it took 3 days. It was over a Memorial Day weekend. And they said because of my mom and our family's help that they were able to locate the remains of Audie Murphy through remote viewing. Exactly, you know, we had never been to that mountainous region at all in Virginia. It's very mountainous up that near Virginia Tech, very close to Virginia Tech, very, very mountainous up that way. And I also, with that, I always felt as the years went by that there was some foul play involved with Audie Murphy's death. I think that there was something, I know that all the people had perished, but I think that there was something about that pilot. There was just something about that pilot. Either something was going on that night. So I think there's
familiarize the audience with Audie Murphy. A little bit of the backstory on that.
Could you repeat that?
Can you just give the audience a little backstory on Audie Murphy?
Audie Murphy is one of the most decorated World War II heroes. He had saved many, many people. He's from Texas. Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, has a whole wing named after him. Many of the Air Force bases, he had saved so many people during his lifetime. And later on, he went on to be a very famous movie star by doing a lot of Westerns. But he's most remembered for saving so many people during World War II. Suffered a lot of wounds, did the Purple Heart and all the rest of the medals that he had received for his bravery. And so going forward, you know, a lot of the Army bases have named places about him.
He was quite a man.
Very much so.
An American hero.
And that was 1971 that his plane disappeared.
We also worked another plane, Stephen Foster, maybe around 2000 year circuit. He went missing in the California Nevada border. Remember that one?
Well, it sure is. The cobwebs in my head, it sure is ringing a bell. Tell me more. Tell us
he
more.
Was an adventurer. He was something like just a multimillionaire, just an adventurer. His plane went missing, and he was known for just flying all over the world trying to break records, like an eccentric millionaire. And
didn't a hiker find like his some kind of identification somewhere out in the middle of nowhere?
Yes. Yeah. And so I was asked to try to remote view and pinpoint with mapping. And he was right where I said, using the Nevada state line and how many miles inward, and gave a description. So they had that. And he was found right where we pinpointed him.
So we have worked on a lot of different, you know, different cases. And I know that you're out in California, but there was a big case in Ohio that a family of eight was murdered all in one evening. And some people had reached out to us to do a psychic reading, a remote reading. And we were able to pick up on that evening that it was a young man that had done it, because the law enforcement and the FBI and the governor had thought it had something to do with a drug cartel. And then also they were kind of like selling marijuana, and they had some other issues going on around there. And it turned out that we were correct and right that the it was called the Rodin murder of eight in Piketon County, Ohio. And so in the beginning, you give this information and people take it and they pass on to law enforcement. And at that time, law enforcement say they didn't need our help, but the family did. And that's okay. They passed it on. They got the notes and they said they got it handled. The cartel did it. But it turned out that our notes was correct, that the young blonde headed man named Jake did it. And he was a 24-year-old young man who had his family to go to each individual location and to kill eight members of that family over a child custody.
Slaughtered them all.
Slaughtered them all.
Went to house to house. That's not the only case.
Oh, my God. Wait, they weren't even like together, like the Covina situation.
They weren't together. They were like a mile. One was a mile away and one was 2 miles away. And just so you know, we were talking Southern Ohio and Northern Kentucky. And that whole family, if you were to kill one family member and they thought it was somebody else, they would probably retaliate. So that person knew they had to wipe out the whole family if they ever suspected that they did that. And that's what they did. And they were men. They were very, very successful, hardworking, down-to-earth men. There was like five men. There was also a couple of 16-year-old girl and 16-year-old boy. Some of them were cousins, and some of them were brothers and sisters, and some of them were husbands and wives. And just the thought of that person, and they were killed like the mafia would. They took a bullet, which I was correct, they shot him in the head, and they shot him. They shot him in their sleep. They got in and they shot them all.
Do you are there any like cases that you absolutely get nothing, no feeling on? I mean, like for example, the alleged college guy that killed the four people in was it Idaho? Sorry,
mm-hmm. Idaho. Yes,
Kohlberger.
Yeah. Would you ever get any kind of feeling on a situation like that?
Well, actually, yes. And I will tell you, actually, yes. But we don't go chasing it. If somebody reaches us, a searcher, family member, law enforcement, DA wants us involved. And so Jeannie did work on it a little bit, and so did I. And she said, I think there's a connection to Pennsylvania. And I go, oh, Jeannie, I don't know about that. And sure enough, Jeannie, there was a connection to Pennsylvania.
And he lived on the other side of the state. Everything's energy. So long as something has energy, which Einstein said you cannot destroy nor create, if you could feel the energy, then you could pick up. So, you know, I felt the energy when he was coming across into Pennsylvania. And I told her, I said, boy, he feels really close by. I go, I wonder if he's from the Pittsburgh area. I just feel him here, some kind of connection. And he ended up being, you know, coming through and in Philadelphia. So you can feel an energy if you're focused on it. But unless we're asked, you know, to focus on something or... No, we don't.
You're not going to throw your two cents.
We still worked on it because we had such a strong vibe. A, we knew that he was a student. We knew what he looked like. We knew that he was all this information that maybe we could pass that on to law enforcement. And they would say, you know what? Maybe we need to take a look at that. It just helps law enforcement to look outside the box and to maybe look at some people. So we had picked up a lot of pointers on it and we had written it down. But we did not get the opportunity except to give it to a searcher. And I don't believe that the people who were doing all that stuff had, you know, passed on to them. Because lots of time people who are already with dogs or searching, they're also like to be involved with, you know, the missing and other kind of stuff, mm-hmm. murders that people, you know, reach out to us. And I do believe that there was, what was that other case that we were on?
I think like he got so involved with his casework and research being a grad student that somehow he channeled a serial killer and helped with, you know, killing these people. I think it was around the holidays too that.
You know what? I hate to do this, but it's time for us to start wrapping this up. And my point being is that will you guys come back another time when we can pick up right from here?
Oh, that would be fantastic. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah,
so people can always get a reading from us if they want to hit psychicvincentsisters.com.
Give us your information, your website. Yeah.
Yeah, psychicvincentsisters.
Well, we got to go quick because I always talk to you.
Psychicvincentsisters.com. If they want to reach out to us about a case or have us to do some remote viewing or even some kind of a reading, that would be fantastic. We're also medical intuitives. We do a lot of different things besides just the criminal profiling.
That's great. So let's do this, because this is how Linda and I are becoming friends. And let's give shout out to Kathy St. George. We love you, Kathy. And
Kathy.
And but yeah, that Linda's been on several times. So let's we need to wrap it up, because I'm always, but we'll do it. Like maybe when you, what's convenient for you guys, maybe in the next 2 weeks or whatever. But Merry Christmas. It's a pleasure to meet you, Susanna, Jean, and Linda. Always fabulous.
Have fun at that party. Merry,
yes.
Oh, do you like three pictures?
Make a drink for me now.
Listen, Merry Christmas to you and yours, and happy belated Hanukkah and all that good stuff. But yeah, I really want to, I want to touch on that guy with that, that with Joe Paterno and
Oh, yeah.
That's where we'll start. Love you guys.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Tune into the Bob Dean Show in 2 weeks.
All right. Thank
you. You're listening to The Bob Dean Show, only on LA Talk Radio.